Time now for our guest speaker, who is, of course, well known to most of us, Alan Knox. Jane and Alan joined the fellowship about 20 years ago. Alan has served the fellowship as president for one or two terms and on a number of committees, including membership, Sunday service, and the Endowment Fund Committee. In 1987, Alan left his work to become the at-home parent to help raise daughter Alyssa and son Trevor. Prior to that, Alan had a career which included youth and resident camp work with the YMCA, adult education and extension work at Grand Prairie Regional College, and as a recreation consultant at SPRA, the Saskatchewan Parks and Recreation Association. In the midst of that, Alan fitted in graduate school and sessional lecturing at the University of Saskatchewan. Please welcome Alan.
Thank you. Did we get the volume or? Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Testing. You can hear me now? Good, thank you. Try to get that out of the way. Again, the book is The God Argument, The Case Against Religion and for Humanism by A.C. Grayling. Whenever one tries to summarize a book, which is fairly comprehensive, it becomes quite a challenge because there's so much information in here and you can't really shorten it so much. Ellen is having the same trouble with the second half for next week. I read the book initially, I underline, I notate, I put question marks where I challenged certain points, that sort of thing. And then when I decided or agreed to summarize the first half, I started over again, taking notes, identifying places where I might use quotations and whatnot. And I got up to about page 15 and I had an enormous amount of written work and I realized there's no way I can do this justice in, 20, 25 minutes. So I had to start all over again and try to shorten it. But that doesn't mean, even if I can only highlight things for you today, if it, what I say interests you at all, it's well worth the read. It is a little bit academic in tone, but he is an academic, so one would expect that. But it's very rich with good information and challenging thoughts, so I would encourage you to take an interest in and dig into it a little bit if you wish. Now, the book was written in 2013. A.C. Grayling is a professor of philosophy and master of the New College of the Humanities in London, UK. A.C. stands for Anthony Clifford. And I noted in the paper this last week that he was the chair of the judges panel that made a major literary award. I've forgotten which one it was now. $85,000 to an Australian novelist for a very interesting novel. So he's well known in that community. So to start, and in shortening it, I actually didn't have enough time. I'm a little bit short in the time. But so what I would like to do is sort of finish what I have here on paper, and then if sufficient time remains, I'd like to read a page or two just to give you an idea of the book, the flavor of the book, and there's a slight connection to Unitarianism in what I'd like to read, so we'll do that. Today one only has to observe the atrocities being carried out by ISIS or ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq, Syria, and the Levant, referring to Lebanon, to realize that religion can have catastrophic impacts on the social order, all in the name of God or Allah. On the CBC program, the Sunday edition, September 28, Michael Enright interviewed Hussein Haghani, a former Pakistan ambassador to the United States, and his wife, Farhanaz Ispahani, a former member of the Pakistan Parliament, in a segment titled, "The Unstable World, Is Pakistan the World's Most Dangerous Country?" They told of a number of horrific behaviors carried out by Islamic fundamentalists in Pakistan, a country which possesses the nuclear bomb. I don't mean to pick on Islam, but what was it a wise man once said? If the shoe fits, wear it. The point is that while religion can have many positive effects, it can also have many very negative effects. Perhaps now in the 21st century, it is time to set aside such beliefs in favor of rational thought and morality for its own sake, without the need for supernatural sanction. A.C. Grayling reflects that while the benefits of religion are mainly personal, committed followers, often believing they have the answer, are prone to impose their views on everyone else. Again, this is especially the case in the world of fundamentalist Islam. History shows that trouble often results when different religious outlooks confront one another, each trying to dominate. The situation with ISIL is a perfect example. While this alone is good argument in favor of humanism, a more important argument is that, quote, religion's claims and beliefs do not stand up to examination. A critical examination of religion's claims place it in the same class as astrology and magic. Religious thought dates from mankind's early history. Our current scientific worldview, however, should supersede these primitive outlooks from the past. While religion can often serve as a comfort, we now have better sources, better grounded in reason, and far closer to the truth. Grayling also reflects that the influences of religion has tended to dwindle where science and education have advanced. Still, there are impediments to this advance. Children are often indoctrinated before they reach the age of reason. There is pressure to conform to social norms even if they are now outmoded. Grayling defines religion as a set of beliefs and practices focused on a god or gods, some form of supernatural being. Here we can include Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Buddhism, Jainism, and Confucianism, for example, are actually philosophies. They do not have a supernatural being at their core. Grayling then goes on to discuss the concept of God, and I quote, "Even more significantly for religious people, the word is typically invoked to denote the all-encompassing and unanswerable source of authority governing what people can think, say, eat, and wear, in what circumstances and with whom they can have sexual relations, how they must behave on specified days or weeks of the year, and so comprehensively on. The fact that different religions claim that their god or gods have different requirements in these respects should be evidence that religions are man-made and historically conditioned. But religious people think that this insight only applies to other people's religions, not their own." Grayling comments that religious apologists tend to invoke ineffability, the concept that God is incapable of being described in words, is inexpressible. They are apt to say that God is, quote, "a mystery too great for our finite minds to comprehend." This closes down conversation, which is, of course, what the apologist wants. They are not receptive to challenge. Such challenges as, how can a benevolent God tolerate evil? If God is all-powerful, why does it tolerate natural disasters and human suffering? With regard to ineffability, Grayling comments further that, but this is exactly what is wrong with a concept that cannot be defined or explained, cannot be tested, cannot even be understood. This is a concept that has no meaning. Grayling comments extensively on many aspects of religion, demonstrating its weakness as a worldview. For example, is scripture literal truth or metaphorical in nature? Unfortunately, many people are prepared to believe scripture is literal truth, even if it clearly cannot be, given what we know now about the physical world. Grayling also reflects on the origins of religion, that it stems from ancient times when stories, myths, and supernatural beliefs served as mankind's earliest science and technology. As religion developed, it became an agent of social control. Its institutionalization as such is one of the principal reasons that religion has survived so long. Grayling also comments on the role of religious indoctrination in childhood. He asks if religious teachings were not taught to people until they had attained maturity, how many would subscribe to a religion? Very likely not many. Quote, physical trees can be cut down branch by branch for practical reasons, but conceptual trees have to be cut down by the root. Grayling uses this analogy to suggest that it is the basis of religious belief alone that requires discussion, as opposed to the various sects of the religions which are much too numerous. If we can reject the premise of religious belief, then we don't have to deal with its numerous ramifications. Grayling draws attention to the fact that many religious adherents are now rejecting much of the church dogma they have been taught. He calls on us to realize that, quote, the primary mark of rationality is reliance on evidence, taking relevant experience seriously, and using associated knowledge and theory appropriately. He challenges us to believe and act upon what we think is rational to believe and act upon, and reject and do not act upon what we believe to be irrational. The agnostic suggests that there is insufficient evidence to prove whether God exists or not. Grayling observed, quote, the mistake made by many is to think that because a particular tradition has been institutionalized in society, it increases the probability that the things it talks about actually exist. We must not allow the argument of probability to supersede the much better argument of rationality. Grayling then goes on to discuss the kinds of evidence that would be required to demonstrate that God does or does not exist. He concludes, the paradigm is science, which institutionalizes publicity, repeatability, and peer review of experiment and test. He further reflects that the beliefs of the various religions are untestable, inconsistent with each other, internally contradictory, and in conflict with the deliverances of common sense and science. Chapter 6 is titled Agnosticism, Atheism, and Proof. Grayling explains these concepts and quotes from Bertrand Russell, who was a famous opponent of religion. He closes the chapter with a statement by W.K. Clifford writing on the ethics of belief. It is wrong always, everywhere, and for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. Grayling now turns to examining arguments for the existence of God. This section is quite detailed and time does not allow us to cover it in detail. It is also somewhat definitional and technical. It is complicated by the fact that it is difficult to prove the existence of something when one doesn't know what it is supposed to be. That is, even if we believe in a deity, we do not know its nature. In this section, Grayling examines the nature and weaknesses of such arguments for the existence of a deity as the teleological argument, or the argument from design, the ontological argument, the claim that a deity exists by definition, the cosmological argument, which infers the existence of a deity from observations about the contingency of the world, and the moral argument that there can be no morality unless there is a deity. By contingency is meant, because the world came into existence, it must have been created. Everything is the effect of a preceding cause. He refers to it as the causal chain. And of course, when one gets to the bottom, you end up, I guess, with the Big Bang or whatever preceded that. Grayling argues that the arguments examined here are actually rationalizations of beliefs which are already accepted. People believe because they have been taught to believe by their parents and by their community. Grayling defines faith as, quote, holding beliefs and accepting doctrines either without evidence or even in the face of countervailing evidence. He declares that faith is not respectable or admirable, but irresponsible, lazy, and too often dangerous. Again, while religious apologists often claim that deity is incomprehensible, they at the same time ascribe to the deity many positive characteristics for which there is no evidence. characteristics we usually approve of and wish we had. Grilling then suggests, think of trying to get an investor to put money into a scheme which cannot be described or talked about. Grilling then explains and describes the weaknesses of the teleological and ontological arguments for the concept of God, from the appearance of design and nature and saying that deity exists by definition or by reason alone. As interesting as this is, we do not have sufficient time to explain it in any detail here. Grayling then moves on to critique in detail the cosmological argument, which, quote, infers the existence of deity from observations about the contingency of the world and the arguments for creationism and intelligent design. Grayling observes, quote, there is no discussing religion without addressing its effect on social policy, medicine and medical research, moral questions, and its relation with science. He observes further that, ultimately, the debate is about which way of thinking and justifying beliefs is the one that will take us toward the truth. Looking forward to next week's presentation, The Case for Humanism, Grayling also states, religion also competes with secular philosophy over the question of the foundations of morality and whether the existence of the universe and humanity serves a purpose set by a supernatural agency, or whether the making of moral meaning is the responsibility of human beings themselves. Next, Grayling discusses in detail the relation between religion and science, with special emphasis on the argument about evolution versus creationism or intelligent design. Again, as fascinating as this section is, we do not have time to consider the details now. Grayling refers to a May 2008 article in the Wall Street Journal, which reports that Gallup polls consistently show that nearly half of American adults reject evolution, and that a third are upset that the schools teach it. Surely this reflects on the sad state of science education in the United States. Grayling closes this section with the statement that the creationists recognize that science radically undermines religion. That is why they fight it with such vigor and resolution. In his conclusion to part one, Grayling states, the cumulative case against religion shows it to be a hangover from the infancy of modern humanity, persistent and enduring because of the vested interests of religious organizations, proselytization of children, complicity of temporal powers requiring the social and moral policing that religion offers, and human psychology itself. Yet even a cursory overview of history tells us that it is one of the most destructive forces plaguing humanity. He further observes, why cannot we have art and music, personal consolation and inspiration, a positive and humane outlook on life, without the ancient superstitions of our remote ancestors as their supposed source, at the cost of the divisions, hatreds, and torments that they bring with them? The answer is, we can. The next part of this book, The Case for Humanism, shows how, and that will be continued next Sunday by Helen. And I will take a moment then to read a page or two for you here. In this section, he's talking about science and creationism and intelligent design. A further inconsistency, therefore, obtains between religious belief about the existence and development of life and the observable facts of biology. Biological design is manifestly not the outcome of previous planning and execution by an intelligent purpose of agency, unless that agency is markedly incompetent. For example, the optic nerve making a blind spot at the center of the retina, or markedly malevolent, for example, the prevalence of agonizing diseases. It has to be taken seriously that Darwin himself saw, in the light of his observations and discoveries, all credibility vanish from religious beliefs. Baptized an Anglican, his early religious observance was Unitarian, a rational and liberal outlook which he abandoned for more traditional Christianity while at Cambridge, where he was greatly impressed by Paley's Evidences and Natural Theology, containing the classic statement of the argument from design. Having given up the study of medicine while at Edinburgh University, Darwin contemplated becoming a clergyman. First, though, he joined the Beagle, a gentleman companion to the ship's captain, Robert Fitzroy, a biblical literalist, who required everyone aboard his ship to attend daily worship conducted by himself. It is interesting that Darwin collected the evidence for his great discoveries, profoundly influenced by the geology he observed, in which screamed aloud the vast age of the planet, while he was in the constant company of a fundamentalist who regarded every word of the Bible as literally true, down to its account of the 6 days of Genesis and the creation of fixed species in the Garden of Eden. Darwin began the voyage a practicing Christian, and by its end, 5 years later, was full of doubt. He had read the first volume of Charles Lyell's three-volume Principles of Geology, 1830-33, while at sea, and later remarked that it was the basis of everything which I have done in science. Lyell showed how ancient the world really is, giving Darwin the necessary eons for a biological evolution to occur. In the late 1830s, Darwin wrote that the Old Testament was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian. Not long afterwards, he wrote of the New Testament that the more we know of the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible do miracles become. The men of that time were ignorant and credulous to a degree almost incomprehensible to us. Even then he hung on to a residual Christian commitment until, by his own account, 1849, he wrote, "I never gave up Christianity until I was 40 years of age." Christianity meant religious faith in general. When at a dinner party in Darwin's company, the Duke of Argyll said that he saw the operation of purposive mind in nature, Darwin shook his head. The traditional pre-scientific beliefs of religion simply could not survive scientific insight into nature, and Darwin experienced that truth firsthand. So, that'll do for today. Thank you. Now, I know we like to take questions, but I don't think I'm going to remember a lot of the detail in this book, but I'd certainly try.
Tell me, you're going to have to wait till I get the mic to you here.
By the Dalai Lama, whether we believe in Buddha or God or follow some other religion or more or none at all, as long as we have compassion for others and conduct ourselves with restraint out of a sense of responsibility, there is no doubt we will be happy. And that is by the Dalai Lama. When you think of good, you miss out the zero, and you've got God.
Uh-huh.
So, could you have comment on both of them?
I think your first part will be spoken to by Helen next week when we talk about humanism as an alternative approach to living one's life fruitfully. The second one is interesting, but sorry.
Only for the British.
Pardon?
Only for the British.
There you go.
I just want to make the comment he doesn't have anything much good to say about having faith. And yet I admire people with faith. I think it makes them more humanistic, and it gives them a lot of personal comfort. Whereas if you don't have that faith, I think you're more in limbo.
Well, part is, obviously, we want people to be comfortable in their lives, and if religion and the faith is part of that, that's well and good for them. But it's when the things like the Islamic fundamentalists, again, and others who want to impose their view on everyone else, as they're now trying to do in the southern United States with the so-called Christian right, building into legislation all sorts of things that most of us would abhor, that it becomes a problem.
Sorry. I'm just going to say, in regard to religion and society, I think that's pretty important to most of us. And just an observation on what the Pope's doing in Italy. And one thing he's doing is he's excommunicating the mafia. And I said to a recently to a Catholic, so why would the mafia care at all? They're a bunch of murderers and killers. And apparently he said, well, he's been to Italy quite a bit. And he said, well, it's a social thing. It's a social thing that you're religious, even if you're a murderer and a thug. And I thought, wow, so that's just the power of ideology and sort of shaping behavior, you know, political behavior. It's amazing.
I have too many comments, probably, but this current government bothers me, as you know. And, you know, they have laid off 4,000 scientists in the last 4 years, and apparently another 3,500 from government are lined up to be laid off, because this government doesn't want any truth in terms of research to be antagonistic towards their view of the world and their policy. So I think the same is true. It's kind of like a religion, and their ideology is like a religion. And I think that is the problem, is they keep saying, I've heard on the radio, people must understand, you know.
Ingrid's comments just caused me to think that whether you are religious or not religious, whether you are political or not political, those groups still try to impose their views on other people as if it is the truth, stated as if it is the truth. And I think in all of that we must maintain skepticism, that the world does not necessarily abound with conspiracy theories. You know, that things are not always seem what we think they might be, but what we choose to believe they think they are in order to support our own particular biases. When we came this morning, I was talking to David about, and David's very interested in, and his father are very interested in humanism. And he was asking me, what was the difference between a Unitarian perspective and a humanistic perspective? And I couldn't answer him, but I know you could.
No, I can't, but on the wall back there by the clock is a very good definition of humanism.
Or if we should say a non-religious perspective, yeah. And actually, a Unitarian perspective.
This is next week's discussion.
Yeah.
But
so
it is
lead
close.
In, lead in here, Alan.
It is close in a sense. You know, I think the Unitarian perspective
is Unitarianism
is
a non-religious perspective.
Is a humanistic one. Well, in some places, because again, you can go to other places where it's more traditionally Christian. We're so broad in our so-called liberal faith. Not defies. I think there's just a variety which we tolerate and permit and welcome. I mean, am I a Unitarian? I'm an atheist. But I attend the Unitarian Fellowship.
You know, I'm always thinking about this because it comes to a point where it's a big business. It's money on the line. And especially when I think about the Pope who just said, you know what, gay people, lesbian, they're Christian. We should accept them born. That's always being a big thing. Say, basically, the Bible is full of it, of this denial. And that is something that has been written by men, for men, and for the purpose of basically getting people to give them money to have the power to do whatever they want. And that's what it is in the right in the U.S. It's what it is in ISIS in Syria. And but that's the thing. I don't know if in the book it speaks, I mean, because you came to it to a point, and I'm pretty sure you've got so many things in it, that it's business. Who is going to have the power and am I justifying the power to get more power? Thank you.
I don't think he really addresses that issue. That would have been a good one for him to include. What was I just going to say? We have a lot of growing up to do as a species. And I guess given what's happening in the world today and with climate change and all of that, you know, it remains to be seen whether we're going to live long enough to mature enough to come into some kind of harmony.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm almost an atheist too, and I was just curious. How much where could you get the book?
Pardon?
Where could you get the God argument book?
Oh, I'm sure the library will have it.
All right, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm curious. There's like that Richard Dawkins book. Did you ever read that one?
I have read one of his books, and I have several at home which I've not yet read.
Oh. Cool.
Also very interesting.
Yeah, I've just, like, I used to be a Catholic when I was a kid, so when I was, like, leaving and all that stuff, and I just realized, looking at it now, that really I kind of became less of a, more towards atheism, because I started to realize how big of a joke religion is, because it essentially is just a government. You know, it's just politics, that's all it is.
Certainly an aspect of it.
I kind of despise both, you know.
There you go.
Sorry.
So, concluding comment by Helen, or?
Sure, I was just going to comment that politics in and of itself is not a bad thing.
No.
I think Victor would agree.
The only thing that I wanted to say, well, is that my problem with God is that whole idea that this is an ultimate, that you can't argue it, that, you know, this undefinable God is there, God is everywhere, so no matter what we say, God is watching, and I can't believe that. I just can't believe it.
I see God as a scientist, and he has started a little colony here to see how it works out, and he's gone off to other parts of the galaxy to try other experiments. We're part of his experiment. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Alan.